Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Like the good policy guy that he is, the president said today he has a plan to fix the unemployment problem.
We'll gather CEOs and small business owners, economists and financial experts, as well as representatives from labor unions and nonprofit groups, to talk about how we can work together to create jobs and get this economy moving again.
What to do when stimulus isn't enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. American Public Media presents Workplace You, an American Radio Works documentary supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday. This one is the 12th of November, and it is great to have you here. Every Thursday morning, the Labor Department releases a statistic that measures first-time claims for unemployment benefits. We don't usually spend a lot of time with it because a weekly number on something big like the U.S. economy, that's a tricky thing. But the president took advantage of a slight drop in first-time claims last week to work his way into the news today. He said he's going to host a job summit at the White House next month. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn what that might entail.
If you ask experts and entrepreneurs what will create new jobs, they'll tell you credit and innovation. Scott Shane studies entrepreneurship at Case Western Reserve University. He says if the administration wants to jumpstart job creation, it needs to pay special attention to small businesses.
Being short on capital, it's very hard for them to expand and hire additional people.
Many entrepreneurs rely on credit cards and home equity to get started, but those lines of credit have dried up. So Shane would like the administration to replace that cash. But money alone might not do it. John Schur is the CFO of a biotech firm in Detroit called Astrant. He says venture capitalists help him hire more than 100 people in the past 7 years. If the government is serious, he says, it should create its own venture firms to focus on priorities like green technology.
That would be brilliant, particularly those that are focused on technology of the future.
Mary Sastry founded Sactree 3, a firm trying to develop the next generation of batteries in Ann Arbor, Michigan. All she wants is a level playing field for the green economy.
That means that the people who produce petroleum and profit from petroleum are also paying the cost of that.
But she says other countries are jumping ahead.
Not only are companies competing in the marketplace, but countries are competing.
Sastry says new jobs will ultimately go to countries that constantly innovate. But right now, she's worried the U.S. has lost its edge, at least in clean tech. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department reported today that the deficit for October hit $176 billion, needless to say, a record. Also needless to say, the White House would love to get that number well down into non-record territory. And they are said to be looking at one of the sources of the red ink in the first place, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, as a way to help do that. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains how it might work.
The TARP account still has $210 billion, but all that money was borrowed in the first place, adding to the deficit. This year's total deficit is projected to hit $1.4 trillion. If the TARP money isn't spent, meaning not borrowed, the estimated deficit would drop to $1.2 trillion. Budget expert Stanley Colander at Corvus Communications says every little bit helps.
It's not so much that they're not going to spend money, it's that they're not going to spend money compared to what had previously been projected to be spent, and therefore the outlook for the deficit will get that much better and government borrowing will be that much lower.
Not spending the borrowed TARP money shows a deepening concern about growing deficits on the part of the administration, but Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says it's too early to start counting that money.
You could have use for the TARP money, unfortunately, and it might be for some regional lenders that could use some additional capital that they can't raise in the market right now.
And Whalen says, don't forget the TARP program has already spent nearly $500 billion in borrowed money to prop up banks. That's contributing to the deficit.
Because we're going to lose money on TARP, too. We're not going to get our money back, and we already have taken a loss on several other companies that have been restructured. So in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter.
Whalen says given the unpopularity of the TARP program, he thinks the Obama administration is gaining a political, if not so much a fiscal, benefit. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the nation's capital today, the Food and Drug Administration was worried about the fine print, the stuff like this that you hear when drug ads air on TV.
Do not take Lunesta with alcohol. Call your doctor right away. After taking Lunesta, you walk, drive, eat, or engage in other activities while asleep. In rare cases...
Disclaimers like that work on television and in print most of the times, but those ads, like everything else, are heading online. And right now, when it comes to online drug ads, the FDA hasn't quite figured out what the rules are. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The pharmaceutical industry wants to advertise everywhere it can. And on the internet, companies can target consumers in ways they can't on TV or in newspapers. Still, Pfizer spokesman Ray Caron says his company is taking it slow.
We are reluctant to jump in with both feet until we have proper guidelines and guidance on how to do it in a way that, again, is most appropriate.
To give you an idea of how anxious the drug industry is to get some guidance from the FDA stat, consider the number 900. That's how many people wanted to get into today's hearing in a room that only holds 350. And the meeting's not just about online advertising, but also the rules about getting a message out on social networking sites.
You cannot ignore Twitter. You cannot ignore Facebook. So we're going to be there.
But just listing all the warnings from that Lunesta ad you just heard would require a tweet-a-thon. So what to do? Some in the industry want to offer a link on ads that'll take consumers to the fine print. Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog, says that is not good enough.
If drug companies are allowed to advertise in the internet without disclosing side effects, because there just aren't enough characters to completely disclose side effects, we're going to see a lot more deaths and injuries from these side effects.
And Court says internet advertising can be policed. Just slap a drug company with an eight-figure fine when they don't disclose side effects, and they'll comply, he says. No word from the FDA on when any new regulations will be proposed. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, day four of the rally was not to be. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President's on his way to Asia this afternoon. Four countries in 8 days, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, and China. But on a day when the Treasury Department announced that record deficit for October, it is the visit to Beijing that's getting most of the attention. Aside from maybe us, China has about as big a stake in how quickly the American economy recovers as anybody does. They own nearly $1 trillion worth of our debt. So they're watching pretty closely as the government tries to spend its way out of recession. Commentator and economist Todd Buchholz says if we are lucky, the Chinese will keep us honest.
American culture is filled with vigilante heroes. Take Batman. Without Batman, the citizens of Gotham would find themselves robbed and ridiculed by the Riddler and the Penguin. Well, these days, the Riddler and the Joker stand for our national debt. As deficit forecasts jump by the trillions, as the ratio of deficit to GDP hits 11% with virtually no plan to rein it in. But who is looking out for the American taxpayer? The Obama White House sounds resigned to breathtaking deficits until the year, pretty much until Generation Y trades in their iPhones for hearing aids. Today, the American taxpayer, faced with a future of rising taxes, has no powerful friend, except one. A vigilante character riding in from the East, the Far East. And the name of that character is China. Follow me here. China is warning the U.S. government to protect our dollar and to protect our runaway budget. Premier Wen Jiabao urged President Obama to, quote, honor commitments and guarantee the security of China's assets, unquote. What are China's assets? $800 billion of our bonds. China is almost begging the U.S. government to show a sense of responsibility. If the U.S. dollar or U.S. bonds collapse, everybody loses. American consumers will get squeezed by higher prices, and China loses as well, since their investments in the U.S. would go poof. Apparently, China cares more about protecting the American taxpayer than our elected officials do. Chinese leaders are the vigilantes trying to protect the American public from a fiscal fleecing. Are they protecting Americans because they are nice? No. Noble? No. Charitable? Ha! Of course it's self-interest. Hey, Not all vigilantes are as noble as Batman.
Economist Todd Buchholz was an advisor to the first President Bush. His latest book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. Tell us what you think. Head to our website. It's marketplace.org. The link you need is the one that says contact. From Bentonville, Arkansas, today came these updates. Walmart reported a better-than-expected quarterly profit, but same-store sales, that is, sales at stores open longer than 1 year, actually fell. That bodes ill for a quick rebound in consumer spending here in the United States. But there is at least one country where people don't mind shopping a bit. The Chilean economy has become much more consumer-centric over the past couple of years. Not always with positive results, though. Chileans are slipping into the same problematic personal debt patterns that we did, sometimes with the help of the world's biggest retailer, as Annie Murphy reports.
It's Saturday morning at Santiago's open-air market. Vendors started arriving here before dawn, bringing with them products from all over the country. Crates of avocados and apples, sides of beef, and barrels of olives. Customers, like Pilar Aval, are packed in shoulder to shoulder, bargaining for their weekly staples.
I buy everything here, fruits, vegetables, dried goods. I've got a large family, so I come because of the prices and because I know what I'm buying.
These markets are a direct link between farmer and consumer and part of daily life across Latin America. But as Chile courts Western development, big stores are changing all that. Last year, Walmart bought the popular Líder chain. Like Walmart, Líder sells everything from electronics to bedsheets, and that includes groceries. But Pilar Val is sticking with the outdoor market.
Here, you have as many choices as a supermarket. But the fundamental difference is everything is fresher.
And yet Chileans are increasingly walking away from traditional markets. A big reason is access to easy credit. Megastores like Líder offer store credit cards to almost anyone. Across town, a Líder store is full of people doing their Saturday shopping, including school teacher Fanny Fuentes.
I hate going to the open-air markets. I like the supermarket. It's easier because you have everything right in the same place.
The tomatoes in Fuentes' cart cost twice what they'd run in an outdoor market. She says she doesn't mind paying more for the convenience. But the problem is, Fuentes is struggling to pay off a large debt she racked up on her store credit card. Those cards carry interest rates starting at 20% and can go almost as high as 50%.
You can get credit, but the interest is really high. I ran up a debt on my Líder card of about $2,000.
That's a lot of money in Chile, where the average annual income is around $10,000 a year. And this is a common problem. The average Chilean family spends two-thirds of its disposable income paying off debt. Last year, Chileans owed $9 billion on personal credit cards, and they defaulted on about a quarter of that sum. University of Chile economist Esteban Puentes says interest rates hit working-class cardholders especially hard.
If you are unemployed and you want to buy something, you could do it and eventually pay later. That's the good part. The bad part is actually people, well, they don't know how much actually they are paying in the interest rate. There is a higher interest rate for poor people, that's for sure.
Puente says large retailers like Walmart Líder make most of their profits from interest earned with these cards. Líder declined to comment on air. In a written statement, the company confirms its rates do increase based on the risk level of clients, and that practice is legal in Chile. The company also says credit lets low-income customers own luxury items like TVs and computers. But many Chileans say they're using that easy credit just to purchase basic necessities. Luis Munoz is an unemployed day laborer. He was at his local Líder with his family. He says he's getting a credit card so he can buy groceries. He says, sure, I worry about generating a debt I can't pay off. But not all of us have easy access to cash. You have to worry about your stomach first, he says, and later about how to pay. From Santiago, Chile, this is Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
Coming up, how to produce songs that sell.
You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. It's like I'm a babysitter, I'm a psychologist, it's anything to get a performance that makes my heart jump.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shed 93 points today, about 0.9%, closed at 10,197. The NASDAQ dropped 17 points, 0.8%, finished at 2149. The S&P 500 gave back 11 points, 1%, finished the day at 1,087. The price of oil fell more than $2 a barrel today, that after U.S. refiners reported an unexpected jump in inventories last month. That proceeded to put a crimp in the pipeline of Chevron and Exxon, each trickled down about 0.4% today. Meanwhile, Walmart rang up a 0.5% gain on those mixed earning numbers we told you about. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.44%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow, Friday the 13th. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for the month of September. In Tokyo, President Obama meets with the Prime Minister of Japan. And the 2009 Realtors Conference and Expo gets underway in San Diego. Topics include green real estate issues, social media, and short sales. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back in the boom days of real estate, investors saw potential profits almost every place they looked. Forget houses and commercial real estate. Even apartment buildings where rents were regulated looked like gold mines. Developers paid luxury prices for those buildings, hoping to turn them into cash cows. Now, though, those properties aren't worth near what they sold for, which is a problem for investors, but it's worse for the people who live in them. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from New York.
For a long time, rent-regulated housing was considered a boring investment. The income was steady, but it was never very big because the city limits the rents, and so they're often well below market rates. Benjamin Dolchin is the director of the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. It's an advocacy group in New York, and he says the real estate boom really changed that.
Starting in about 2005 is that these private equity funds began to notice rent-regulated real estate as an undervalued potential investment.
He says in New York alone, developers backed by private equity firms bought up about 100,000 units. Now, that's about 10% of the city's rent-regulated housing stock. The idea was to make more money from the buildings by raising the rents dramatically. Emily Yusof is a housing consultant. She says this is how the developers plan to do it.
In the future, 3 or 4 years down the road, the new owner would be able to turn over the tenant and make these buildings into more luxury buildings as opposed to middle class, working class, or even lower income units.
The prices the developers paid for the buildings were based on much higher rents than the apartments had been getting. And the developers took out big mortgages to pay for them. But they haven't been able to get low-paying tenants out of the building fast enough, and they underestimated how much it costs to operate these buildings. So the developers just aren't getting the income they need to pay their expenses. Yusof says the money problems are starting to show.
In a number of buildings, you're beginning to see the owners milking the building for the money that is there. They're not paying their mortgages. The maintenance of the building is going down. The violations are going up.
I went to visit Yolanda Nava Juarez. She lives in a rent-regulated building in Upper Manhattan with her husband and their two teenagers. The building is owned by a developer called Vantage Properties, which got backing from a private equity firm to buy it. Vantage paid about $15 million for it in 2007. And it was part of a whole real estate portfolio. The mortgages were then securitized and they were sold off as investments. Naba Juarez comes from Mexico. She doesn't speak English, and she doesn't really know anything about her landlord, except that she can't get the company to fix things, like the hole in her bathroom ceiling or the broken refrigerator. But she and her family may have much bigger problems to deal with. Benjamin Dolchin's advocacy group has been analyzing data from the SEC and from loan servicers. And they found that many of the developers of rent-regulated buildings in New York, including Vantage, just aren't making enough money to keep paying their mortgages.
This is sort of not just a disaster in the making. This is a disaster that is sort of already happened and clearly shows that these buildings are really grossly distressed.
Neil Rubler is the CEO of Vantage. He wouldn't talk to me about the specifics, but he did say all of his buildings are all already profitable. He says these buildings were meant to be long-term investments, and his plan is to use technology and economies of scale to make them more profitable.
We believe that by operating our business more efficiently, we can provide a better quality product and higher quality services to our consumer, and therefore raise their standard of living while at the same time keeping the product ultimately affordable to them.
But the mortgages on a lot of these buildings are starting to come due. The developers can't afford to pay the loans off, and the banks won't refinance because they think the investments are just too risky. Yusuf, the housing consultant, says this is starting to happen all over the country.
Anywhere where you have a high concentration of renters, you'll see issues like this. And, of course, California, Florida, Illinois, Chicago, New York, D.C.
She's been talking to lenders and government officials to get them to work with building owners because she says entire neighborhoods are at stake. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The sequel to the hit teen vampire movie Twilight opens a week from tomorrow. New Moon will be in theaters November 20th. It has the familiar cast of characters and a soundtrack, actually, that's not so bad. It's loaded with songs from a bunch of indie bands, including one track from Death Cab for Cutie. Soundtracks on movies or on television have become a great way for bands kind of on the margins to hit the mainstream. Death Cab's guitarist and producer Chris Walla is here to talk about doing business as a band. Chris, it's great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Did you ever think back in the early days of indie rockdom when you were starting this band that you guys would be on a teen tween movie like this new Twilight film that's coming out?
Are we in that movie?
Well, you guys not, but the music, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah. No, I never thought we'd be a part of anything like this. It's pretty strange to be part of something that's such a massive cultural juggernaut.
Do you capitalize on that, or are you just going to ride it and see what happens?
In terms of where we are as a band, it's sort of more, for us, I think, really just cool to be involved in something that's such a huge thing. It's just an exciting thing to be able to do, like 11 years into our career.
Not the first time down this particular pike. I mean, you guys were on the OC for a while, and that was huge.
The OC was really interesting because we got that request before the pilot for that show had even aired.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we didn't know anything about the OC, and nobody knew anything about the OC when that request came through. So that was just an opportunity to be a part of something that was new and seemed like it might be okay and at least not damaging to our career.
You are also the producer of this band.
Yes.
And this is something I have always wondered, and I didn't really understand it until I got into radio, but how do you produce a record album? I mean, what's involved in that?
Being a record producer is... it's a lot of different things. Like, I sort of feel like I'm a yes man, and I'm an enabler, and then I'm the bad cop, and then I'm the dealer, and sometimes I'm the, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on. It's like I'm a babysitter, I'm a psychologist, it's anything to get a performance that makes my heart jump.
How does that work, though, in a group of four people who've been together for 10 years who, when you guys are on tour, you're living, eating, and sleeping, and
yeah.
And that whole deal?
It's insane. It's a terrible thing to do. I could never recommend it.
but you do it actually on the side, too. I mean, you do a bunch of smaller indie label and indie bands and, yeah, and all of that.
Yeah. It's I mean, I got into this band by way of recording. Like, when I maxed out my first credit card, I didn't buy a guitar. I bought a tape machine and I bought a microphone and a couple mic pre's, and I sort of went that route. That was always the thing I was really interested in.
Yeah, you know, it's actually interesting that you bring that up, this whole credit card maxing out thing, because you were up in Portland, Oregon, this past Monday doing a live event with our Personal Financial Marketplace Money. They're doing a special program on personal finances for kids. But, you know, I have to imagine that being in a successful rock band is about the best thing that ever happened to your personal finances.
It is the best thing that ever happened to my personal finances, that's true. But the process of getting to that point is the worst thing that you could possibly do to your finances.
How so? Because you have to max out the credit cards.
Because you have to max out a bunch of credit cards with the hope that someday those credit cards will... I mean, it's layers upon layers of risk.
Yeah. When you mentor and produce these younger bands, do you give them the personal finance spiel and say, listen, this is a bad way to do this. Do it another way. Find a better way to get yourself up and running.
The thing that I always try and... in part on bands who are just getting started, is that your band is a business and you have to treat it like a business. Even if you're playing for 10 people and tickets are $5 and you lose money on the show, if you are making t-shirts and you're selling t-shirts to people, your band is a business. Hmm. And there's a lot that you can do in cash just under the table, but it gets to a point really quickly where that gets to be tricky.
Chris Walla, he's the guitarist and the producer for Death Cab for Cutie. We're going to go out on your new single off that Twilight album, Meet Me on the Equinox, it's called. And for more information about that special broadcast of Marketplace Money, it's on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which hindsight is 2020, 10 years ago today, President Bill Clinton signed a piece of legislation known as the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. No reason you should recognize that off the top of your head, except for this. It repealed a different law, one known as Glass-Steagall, which since the days of the Depression had forbidden investment banks from commingling with plain old commercial banks. There is a pretty substantial school of thought that says the repeal of Glass-Steagall helped make the financial crisis we're living in now all the worse. One last note about that signing ceremony from 10 years ago. It was presided over by the then Secretary of the Treasury, a guy named Larry Summers, who, if I'm right, has a job in the White House now, doesn't he? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 93 points, less than 1%. The NASDAQ off 17 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 11 points. That is more than 1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up tomorrow morning on the Marketplace Morning Report, when, oh when, will small businesses start hiring again? And coming up on this broadcast tomorrow afternoon, why electric bikes have hit electronic stores.
Americans are very, very sensitive to dollars and cents. And as the price of oil goes up, we're going to have a rapidly developing business here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for all of that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.